Well, what's a Christian? How do you become one? You ever had anyone actually ask you that question? Put you on the spot and you get a little bit tongue-tied. You sort of stop there and you think to yourself, well, how should I answer this? How much do I have to include? Where should I stop in what it is to be a Christian and how to become one? We aren't always sure how to put it in a way that people will understand. But it's what the first three chapters of Romans have been building to. What is a Christian? How do you become one? A Christian is someone who trusts that Jesus, the Son of God, took their sins on himself, paid for that sin by his death on the cross and was raised to life again. And he gave us his righteousness, his faithfulness to God, in exchange for our sin. You become a Christian by trusting in Jesus, by putting your faith in him. The key verse we looked at as we built to that last week was Romans 3, verse 22. The righteousness of God has been given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. That's what a Christian is. Someone who puts their faith in Jesus, someone who's had their sins forgiven by God because their faith is in Jesus. And you become a Christian by faith alone, which can seem very simple, but we make it not simple because we do not like the idea of faith alone. We have objections to that. It doesn't recognise things I've done. It doesn't recognise things that person's done. It doesn't recognise all sorts of stuff. We want to actually claim some kind of credit for everything that we do. We want to claim some sort of credit for us becoming a Christian or prove it in some way. And so we add extra requirements, extra steps, not always formally, but in our minds, in our hearts. Because that's what it is to have a sinful human nature. But there are some systems which formally put other requirements before you become a Christian. Roman Catholicism is a fantastic example of that. Roman Catholics will say you need faith to be saved, but you can't be saved until you first become part of the Roman Catholic Church. And you're baptized by a Roman Catholic priest in a Roman Catholic ceremony. It's only after you've become part of the church that your faith will become effective. Now, you might know Roman Catholics who don't say this or don't believe it personally, but that's actually the formal teaching of the Roman Catholic Church, that there is no salvation for anyone outside the Roman Catholic Church. Which, funnily enough, is exactly the same issue that a lot of Jewish Christians had in the early church. Exactly the same way of thinking. It kept coming up. We see it all the way through the New Testament. In Acts 15, here in Romans 3 and 4, in Ephesians chapter 2 and 3, in Philippians 4, in all of Galatians. It goes on and on. This is a huge issue. How do you become a Christian? Who can become a Christian? What is a Christian? And the argument for a lot of these early Jewish Christians was, well, Jesus is Jewish. He's descended from Abraham, the father of all the Jews. And God promised that he would bless Abraham's descendants. That's us Jews. And so if you want to receive the blessing that God has promised through Jesus, you need to be one of Abraham's descendants. You need to be one of the Jews. You need to be you need to be circumcised. You need to put yourself under the law. You need to become Jewish. And then your faith in Jesus will become effective. God will bless you. Salvation's for anyone who will become Jewish and then put their faith in Jesus. See the similarity there with Roman Catholic teaching? And in both cases, it's based on bad theology, which Paul is clearing up here in Romans 3 and 4. So Paul begins his explanation in Romans 3:27 by explaining that no one's got anything to boast, no one's got anything to brag about in their salvation, because we haven't done anything to earn or qualify for that salvation. Because salvation doesn't come from obeying the law, doesn't come from being Jewish, it comes from faith, and faith alone. And it's the same way for everyone. Verses 29 to 31 as well. There's only one God, and because there's only one God, there's only one way of being saved. For Jews, the circumcised, and non-Jews, the uncircumcised, or the Gentiles. So the question then becomes, there's only one way, which way is it? Is it through faith in Jesus, if you're first Jewish? Or is it through faith in Jesus and it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or not? And Paul says to answer that question, we need to go back to the start of all the Jewish people, the first Jew, to Abraham, our father. Let's see what God says in the Bible about Abraham becoming saved or being declared righteous. That's at the start of Romans chapter 4. What does the Bible say about Abraham being saved or Abraham being made righteous? Did Abraham have to do anything first? Well, Paul quotes Genesis 15:2, which says, Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. Now, there's a little brief explanation here. You may wonder, is there a difference between believe and faith? It's actually the same word in the Greek, but we use the words differently in English, but it's the same thing. So believe is the same as faith, is the same as trust. They're all translated from the one Greek word. And so the passage says, Abraham had faith in God. He believed God. He trusted God. And it was that faith for which he was credited righteousness. So Paul then wants to illustrate the difference between faith and works, what it means. And he does it, the next passage, with a bit of a financial explanation. What's the difference between work? What is work and credit that happens with that? And if you don't mind, I'll update that just a little bit. Modern terms, expanded a touch. So picture me taking out my phone, opening up my banking app, and having a look at my statement there. As I look at it, there's things that appear in red, lots of them. That's where I'm spending money. And then occasionally there's a green one, which is where money's coming into my account, a credit. That's what Paul's talking about here. How do we get credited things? It says there's two ways of doing it, but there's, we'll think three in our terms. There's three types of credits in my account as I look at my bank statement. The first one is from an employer. If I've had a job, I've done some work, my employer has to pay me for that. They're obliged to pay me for that, for things that I've done. That's the type of credit. That's a work. And Paul says, well, that's like earning your salvation by obeying the law or doing something else. I've done all of this, so God's obliged to save me. And Paul says, no, that's not how it works. That's salvation by works, not salvation by faith. The second type of credit, which Paul doesn't describe here, they didn't have it in their day, but we've got them here today, is a credit from Centrelink. If I've been down to Centrelink, I've registered with them, I've filled out all their paperwork, I've met their requirements, they are obliged to pay me for that every week. You think, well, you know, you haven't done anything for that, you haven't done any work, but actually they're obliged to do it. It's an entitlement based on who I am. That's another type of salvation by works. That's what it is. Oh, I'm Jewish, so therefore I'm God's people, so therefore God's got to bless me. I'm Roman Catholic, therefore God's got to bless me because I'm part of the church. It's another type of salvation by works. But there's a third type of credit in my bank account. It's a gift. It can come from anyone. It can come from my dad or my mum. Can come from a friend of mine. It can come from anything, anyone, someone who just thinks I might be better off with a bit more money in my account. And they're not obliged to give that to me. I haven't done anything to earn it, even if I'm related to them. There's no obligation that they've got to put that money in my account. It's a gift, freely given. And that, says Paul, is the difference between salvation by works and salvation by faith. Salvation by faith is all about the person who's giving it to me and why they're giving it, and not about anything to do with me. It's all about who God is. God's generosity, God's goodness, God's love and mercy poured out on someone, and not about what I've done or who I am or anything else. Salvation by faith alone. And then to back that up, to say, well, it's not just Abraham. Paul says, this is all through the Old Testament, everywhere. He says, have a look at what David, King David, says in Psalm 32. He quotes that bit. Blessed is the one whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the one who God forgives. Blessed is the one whose sin the Lord will never count against them. He says, look at that and think about it. It's not, blessed is the one who's kept the law and so God will forgive them. It's not, blessed is the one who's gone and done the sacrifices so that God will forgive them. It's not, blessed is the one who's never done any sin and so God is giving them good life and blessings. No, no. It's, blessed is the one who God takes away their sin, who God does it all for. He says, David knew that. It's the same thing that Abraham knew. That when we come to God, it's not with anything we've done. It's not with any qualification. It's not with any family connection. It's just purely through trust, through faith, that God will do what he's promised and pour out blessings on those who believe. This is all about God's gift. And so this is all about who God is, the character of God. God's not someone who sits up there and says, well, I will help you if you help yourself first. I will help you if you do that. God's not like that. He says, I love you. I know you can't do anything to help yourself. I know that you're a sinner. So if you trust me, I'll do it all for you. God is gracious. God is loving. God is generous. God is merciful. This is the God who's shown to us and displayed to us in this salvation by faith alone. This is our God and the one who is worthy of our devotion and our love. But then, because it's not never that simple when people are involved, we always want to go, but and if and what about this? Paul goes back to the question, Romans 4 verse 9, who is this blessedness for? The blessings promised by God. Is it for the Jews, the circumcised, or the Gentiles, the uncircumcised? I think we've answered this. He goes, well, no, it's a little bit more complicated in some people's minds. A little quick explanation here. Circumcision was the first part of the law that God gave to Abraham and Abraham's descendants to differentiate them as a sign to show you are Jewish. You're Jewish if you're circumcised. You keep the law. That's the first part. That's what it is. Everyone who's not circumcised, they're non-Jewish. It was the clear distinction that was being made. So Paul's saying here, let's look at this again. Did God declare Abraham righteous by faith before or after he was circumcised? Let's make sure of this. Before or after he became Jewish? It turns out Abraham was declared righteous by faith in Genesis 15, then became Jewish by circumcision in Genesis 17. So the conclusion is you don't have to become Jewish in order to be saved by faith. Saved by faith comes first for Abraham, and so there's no requirement to become Jewish for the early Christians in order to be saved by faith in Jesus. And for us, you don't need to become Roman Catholic first. or have Christian parents, or be going to church, or follow any particular rules, or reach a certain level of moral acceptability, or be any particular type of person before you put your faith in Jesus. Being a Christian is open to anyone and everyone who puts their trust in Jesus, who believes that Jesus died for their sins, who accepts that Jesus was raised from the dead and offers his righteousness, the forgiveness of sins and eternal life with God for all who believe. For all. With no prerequisites, no qualifications, no need to do anything or be anything. This is a free gift for anyone who trusts Jesus. Faith alone. But Paul goes further than this. Because it's not just a matter of whether Abraham was circumcised before or after God credited righteousness to him. Because God made a whole lot of promises to Abraham. And so there's a question here about how are these promises fulfilled? It's quite theological at this point. Paul does come back to this in Romans 9 to 11 in a lot more detail. So we'll move fairly quickly through here, but I don't think it's right to skip over half of Romans 4 because it's difficult. So hold on while we do the theological stuff briefly and see where we go. So Paul's saying, well, there are Jews and then there are proper Jews. Now, Jews are genetically descended from Abraham, but only some of those who are descended from Abraham are actually proper Jews. So what does that mean? We'll quickly work through that. From verse 13 and on, Abraham was the first Jewish person. God made promises to Abraham that he would bless Abraham's descendants, that God would bless the world through Abraham's descendants, and that Abraham would be the father of many nations. Now, you did a series on Abraham in this church end of last year or sometime in the second half of last year, so you'd be familiar, most of you, with some of that. Now, all the Jews were descended from Abraham, blood descendants genetically connected. They called Abraham their father. They obeyed the laws that God gave Abraham and Moses. God blessed them, and he had blessed the world through them in Jesus. And so as far as a lot of Jewish Christians were concerned, box tick, promises fulfilled. We're Jewish, Jesus is Jewish. We've got this blessing, we're giving it to the world, that's it. But more than that, there was another group of people, Edomites or Ishmaelites, same sort of term. They were genetically descended from Abraham, but they weren't Jewish. And so they go, and look, see, Abraham's the father of many nations, he's the father of the Jewish nation, he's the father of the Edomite nation. And so that's another box ticked as far as the early Jewish Christians were concerned. God kept all of those promises. But Paul says here, no, that's not how those promises are kept. Because it's only the Jews who have the faith of Abraham that are the true descendants of Abraham. It's not just about genetics. Because Abraham had faith in God before he became Jewish through circumcision. And so Abraham's descendants are those who have the same faith as Abraham. You can be genetically unrelated to Abraham, but have his faith, and so be a true descendant of Abraham. Or you can be genetically descended from Abraham and not have his faith, and so only sort of be a descendant of Abraham genetically, but not a true descendant of Abraham by having his faith. And in this way, Paul explains, God is blessing Abraham's descendants, the descendants of faith, the ones who have the faith of Abraham. God's blessing the world through those who have the faith of Abraham. Through Jesus. And God is, and Abraham is the father of many nations, not because the Edomites descended from Abraham, but because people from any nation and every nation can have the faith of Abraham. And so he can be the father of the people of those nations too. Paul says that's how these promises are fulfilled, by faith, not by descent. Although there's that overlap. Jewish people, Jewish Christians, have faith in Jesus. They're also saved. They're also part of that. There's an overlap there. But we've got to be careful to keep the two separate. It's through faith that all of these promises are fulfilled. Not genetics, not the law, not circumcision, but by faith. And so Paul explains here, Abraham is our father in the sight of God, in whom he believed, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into being things that were not. Which indicates we're not yet out of the theological woods, because there's a whole bit of this is linked to dead and life, and there's a whole bit that comes on with that. So, continuing on with this theological work here, Paul describes the proof of the fulfillment of God's promises in terms of God overcoming death. Now, he says Abraham had faith that God would fulfill this promise of a descendant, is verse 19, even though he was so old that he was as good as dead. Now, he wasn't dead, but he's saying he's as good as dead, he's that old. The emphasis here is on death. Death is in the way of the promise being fulfilled. And Abraham's wife, Sarah, her womb was also dead. Now, that's just an expression. It means she'd gone through menopause, can't have kids anymore. But instead of saying she couldn't have kids, it was an emphasis on death. Death was in the way of God fulfilling his promises. So how could Abraham believe? How could Abraham trust God? But he did. And what Paul's explaining here is that even though death was the obstacle, God showed that he could bring life through death. And so Abraham and Sarah had a son, Isaac, the fulfillment of the promise. Not because they could do something themselves, they were as good as dead, but because God could do it when they could not. Now, which comes down to a lot of the way that we think about faith, doesn't it? What are we trusting God for? Where and when do we think God can act? I can see how God could do this because I could do that, or that person could help out. I can work out how God can help me. Or do you know, God has the power to do anything and everything. He can even overcome death. Abraham's faith was credited to him as righteousness, and God proved the validity of that faith by overcoming death. And then as we come down to verse 24, to faith in Jesus, we find that all who have faith in Jesus will also be credited with righteousness on the basis of faith alone, just like Abraham was, even though we've got a problem of death. Yeah, first three chapters of Romans emphasizes over and over and over again that we are dead in our sins, that we are under the penalty of death because we have rebelled against God, that the wages of sin is death. There's all this focus on death, and yet God has proved that salvation is by faith, that God does it because he raised Jesus to life from the death. Just as he fulfilled the promise to Abraham of a descendant, Isaac, through death, defeated death and provided life, so Jesus has defeated death and been raised to new life so that we can know that salvation is by faith and by God's work and not by our own efforts. Same faith, same result. We are saved by faith in Jesus. The fulfillment of God's promises of blessing to Abraham are fulfilled in Jesus, proved by God raising Jesus from the dead. So what do we do with all of this as we pull it all together? Well, the minor point that we look at, the secondary one that I want to focus on this morning, is that our faith in Jesus is proved valid by the resurrection. I've come across a lot of people who think that Christianity is just nonsense and fairy tales and made up stuff. It's pie in the sky when you die. There's nothing here and now. It's only after you're dead, so no one can prove anything. So you can believe what you want, just like believing any fairy tales or make-believe stuff. But the resurrection of Jesus proves those criticisms are hollow. It's not just our hope that something will happen. We're assured that something will happen. Because God has overcome death. God raised Jesus from the dead. The promises of the forgiveness of sins, peace and blessing from God for eternity, eternal life, all of this is proved by the resurrection. And if you're interested, there's plenty of wonderful evidence to focus on for the resurrection, to be assured that it happened, that it's true. There's a great book called The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. He was a non-Christian, American reporter, investigative journalist, and his wife became a Christian. And he said, I'm having none of this. She's just believing fairy stories. This is nonsense. It's for weak-willed people who can't handle reality. So he said, what I'm going to do is investigate the whole lot, just like I would any crime story that I report for in the paper, and I'm going to show that Jesus never rose from the dead, so all of this is made-up nonsense. So did a lot of stuff. He went and interviewed world experts in all sorts of things, and he was convinced by the evidence that Jesus did rise from the dead, and he became a Christian. It's a fantastic story. He's got a book of it. There's a documentary, a film, a whole lot. But there is proof for the resurrection. It's a sure thing. That's one thing I want us to take away from that. Be convinced that God is able to do all that he promises to do. And that's proved in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. But that's the secondary thing. The most important thing for us to take away from this, you may have guessed it already, I've mentioned it once or twice, is that faith alone is how we are saved. You become a Christian by faith alone. God's righteousness is credited to you by faith alone. And we need to recognize that we all have a tendency to move away from faith alone, to add to it, or to doubt that it's sufficient. And there's two sides of that spectrum. You know, for some people, they look and think that they're convicted of their sin all the way through first chapter. I know I'm a sinner. I know I'm wicked. I know I don't deserve anything. I know I'm under the judgment of God. And they'll say, and so how could God possibly save someone like me? I've done nothing to deserve it. I'm not worthy of it. And yes, that's the whole point, which is why you can be saved by faith alone, because it's God doing it all as a free gift. And he raised Jesus from the dead to prove it. So that's on the one side. But on the other side, we always like to think there's something about me, that I'm a little bit better than other people who aren't saved, or even better than other people who are saved. We do that in every area of our lives. I work harder than that person. I deserve my pay more than them. I deserve a promotion over them. Maybe I don't work harder, but I'm smarter. And so I deserve a promotion, or I'm better than they are. My kids behave better than their kids. So I'm doing something better with my parenting, or I'm a better person, or I've got something right. No matter what it is, we always compare ourselves to someone else favorably, to show that we have earned something, we deserve something, we've got credit. That is human nature. And that's what we unfortunately take to salvation by faith. It's one thing for us to recognize the falseness of a whole system like Roman Catholicism, which says you've got to do this first. It's a slightly different thing for us to recognize that we have that tendency too. I'll illustrate it briefly. When I was a pastor in Perth, I had someone come to discuss a situation with me. A non-Christian lady had become a believer in their church, but there was argument about that. There were some people who weren't happy with that because she'd been living in a de facto relationship for years. And they said, no, she's living in sin. She can become a Christian, but she has to make a choice first. Is she going to leave her partner Or is she going to get married to her partner, but until she deals with that sin problem, she can't become a Christian? Form of salvation by works. Yeah, and sometimes you understand where that type of thinking comes from. Because they're looking and going, hang on, my kid's sitting here in the congregation, or my friend's kids are sitting there and they've not been baptized. How come that person jumps the queue ahead of them when they live a much better life? You hear that kind of thing come out in churches. When someone says, why is that person allowed to serve and that person's not? That person's been here longer. That person's done more. That person is a nice, but we love them, we care for them. You know, we grow up in churches, we're part of church, we know and love and care for other people, we see them and we don't want them to be upset, we don't want to hurt their feelings. And the easiest way to do that is to focus on works, who they are, who they're related to, not what they believe. I found myself in that situation. I left home after growing up in a Christian home, going to church every week, to youth group, bringing my friends from school along to youth group when they'd say yes. Joined the army, went off to Adfa and Duntroon in Canberra. And I went to the Christian group there. Not all the time. Lots of other things to do, but semi-regularly. I had a mentor assigned to me. An officer had come and sit down and read the Bible with me each week and go through that. I'd go off and do the Christian ski trip. I'd drive people out to that. I'd drive people to Bible studies off base. And when I graduated, I thought to myself, I know a lot of Bible stuff. I'm a pretty moral person, certainly better than almost everyone else around here. I've got a lot to offer new Christians coming in, just starting their first year. So I applied to be one of these mentors, just like I had, doing a Bible study with someone, reading the Bible with them as they started out in their military career. So I applied to the Navigators program with the officer in charge of that, who came and interviewed me, and he rejected me on the spot, said, sorry, this isn't for you. And that upset me a lot, because I'd been to all of this stuff. I knew my Bible. I was a good moral person. But in just talking to me, he understood I had no idea that I was saved by faith. I thought I was saved by my good deeds, by my superior morality. Not that I was particularly moral, but I was superior in my mind to other people. I thought my participation counted. And it hurt a lot to be told, no, you're not actually a Christian. We can take that same attitude of pride in what I've done, in my family, and what they've been, in the participation, and ignore salvation by faith, the centrality of it. Because we don't want to upset someone. We don't want to tell them, you don't really get it yet. No matter what you do get, you don't get that. And that is all it is to become a Christian. None of what we do is relevant to our salvation. It's only our trust in Jesus and God's work that saves us. Which is why the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, keep coming back to salvation by faith. That's why Paul's pointing out so strongly here. It's not about being Jewish and descended from Abraham. It's about faith that Abraham had and having faith in God, that God will do it all for you. That's what it is to be a Christian. I was reading through Deuteronomy 5 and 6 this morning. Yeah, there's a lot of emphasis there on what you do. When you come into the promised land, make sure you keep the Sabbath. Make sure you keep the commandments. Make sure you do these things. But right at the start, before all of those things, love the Lord your God with all your heart. You love because you trust. And all of the other things happen after. even in the Old Testament. We don't think of it much, but this is why Paul's going there. It's all about trust in God and not what you do. Go back and look through all your favorite stories in the Old Testament and go, is this actually about what someone's doing, or is it faith first? Is God doing all the work here, or is it someone else doing all the work? It's all about God and his gift and his goodness. That's why Paul spends so much time in this letter, in all his letters, reminding us that God has given us something amazing in Jesus, something that is a free gift, the forgiveness of sins, that's accessed by faith alone. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what you've done, doesn't matter who you're related to, doesn't matter anything else other than, do you trust Jesus? Is your faith in him? No requirements, no preconditions, no prerequisites. Salvation for all who believe. Because our God is a generous, holy God who knows that we need him to do it for us. And this is wonderful, good news for everyone. And something we should share with everyone we come across. Saved by faith alone. That's what it takes to make someone a Christian. Faith alone.